This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the MDT podcast. I am Jo Preston, and I'm a geriatrician in London.
I'm Ian Wilkinson. I'm a geriatrician down in Surrey, and I work in Redhill. And the faculty for this episode, in addition to Jo and I, are...
And I'm Caris Fleming. I'm a CMT2 at East Surrey Hospital.
I'm Chris O'Connor, and I'm the consultant admiral nurse at East Surrey Hospital.
I'm Wendy Grosvenor,
who is a senior lecturer in nursing at the University of Surrey.
And this episode, we're going to be talking about communicating with relatives.
And so coming up this episode, we are going to have a think about trying to get you familiar with some models of communication that may help when you're talking to relatives. We're going to have a think about some common clinical situations where communications might be a bit tricky and how to navigate the legal and some of the ethical principles of that. And we're hopefully going to help you be a little bit more comfortable and effective with your communication with relatives and to understand some of the factors that might make communication with relatives just a little bit more challenging. We're going to reference back to a couple of the other episodes as we go through.
But first, social media. What have you got this week?
So I've got a tweet from Grandma Williams, who is at Joyce Williams _. And she sent me a tweet linking to one of her blog articles. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about Joyce before, and she's a retired physiotherapist that just has a really good outlook on ways of thinking about older people. And so what she asked me was, is it time to rethink the word fit? What does it mean to be fit in our later years? And she said it's certainly not the ageist versions of 90-year-olds who, inverted commas, are still running marathons. And her article goes through that about sort of saying, well, at each stage of our life, what is fit? You know, is it being able to run marathons? Well, that's super fit. You know, there are levels before that. Is it being able to do weird and wonderful yoga poses and this, that and the other, which it probably not. You know, why do you need to be able to just wrap yourself in circles? But, you know, she just poses the question. That was a really nice little article.
Yeah,
I'll put a link
absolutely
to that in the show notes.
Great. So I've got one that was from the BGS that was tweeted, and it's called Read for the Solutions and Stay for the Science. And it is a review of a book by a nurse, which is a registered nurse with a PhD, so Dr. Sarah Russell, RGN. She's a carer and has done some research before as well, and she's done a review of this book called Practical Nutrition and Hydration for Dementia-Friendly Mealtimes. That was really quite nice. And she tweets for We End of Life and Learn Hospice as well. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's quite a nice book to read.
Cool.
And great topic.
And this is Dan Thomas with his piece from social media this week.
My social media highlight this week is from the Curbsiders Internal Medicine. They produced a podcast and infographic on urinary tract infections about stopping overdiagnosis and overprescribing antibiotics for UTI. And they make a very good point of when we're saying UTI that we should probably be using air quotes. They talk about asymptomatic bacteria, and that 15 to 50% of men and women in long-term care facilities have bacteria in the urine. They mention that urine isn't sterile, and they talk about the problems of using malodorous urine as a symptom or sign of UTI. And they also mention our problem that we discuss quite a bit, which is performing dipsticks as a diagnostic test in people with delirium and diagnosing delirium secondary to UTI based on a positive urine dipstick. I shared this on Twitter, and you can follow other similar things with the hashtag Eurosceptic and Don't Be a Dipstick.
And Caris doesn't know I'm going to do this, but you've set up a project at work, haven't you, looking at the welfare of some of our FY1s.
Yeah, that's right.
So, do you want to talk about what that is?
So we've set up basically a buddy system, pairing all of our FY1s with a more senior mentor who is either a junior doctor or a physician's associate, or some of our resus officers are acting as mentors as well, just to provide them with a bit of support on a sort of peer-to-peer level, rather than support that exists for them already, which is just consultant, educational supervisor, clinical supervisors. So if they're having any problems, clinical or personal or anything at all, that they've got somebody that they can talk to.
And I'm sure if anyone wanted to contact us, I could put you in touch with Caris and you could talk about how you could roll that out across other trusts.
Yes, please.
Well, you're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am on Twitter. I think I'm at Dr. Karis, I think.
If she's not, we'll put in the show notes what she is. So this episode, we're going to talk about communicating with relatives. Communication is such a big topic for us to talk about. This was one that we put out to Twitter before we decided this series what we were going to do. So we really had to narrow it down to which element of that we were going to do. And we thought we wouldn't try and talk to you about how to talk to other people, but adding another relationship into the dimension makes that somewhat more tricky. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and we're going to focus around there.
So communication is really the key in the way that we as humans form and maintain relationships between individuals. And it's important in every walk of life. In particular, what we're concerned about is the therapeutic relationship between a healthcare or social care worker and the person that they're working with. And this requires open and clear communication in both directions, actually. It's a two-way thing. And we need to be aware that as a health and social care provider, we're in a position of
automatic power.
Automatic power, yeah. It's kind of like there's a theory in education to do with powerful knowledge. And it's kind of analogous to that. So it's not sort of power, but the power play that does, you know...
Whether you want it or not, it's kind of assigned. Exactly. And so you have to make a bit of extra effort, actually, usually on our end, to adjust that balance so that it can be clear and open.
So in this episode, we're going to concentrate mainly on communicating with relatives and how we navigate that dynamic.
So many of the things we're going to be talking about today, I guess we'll tie in with the principles that we use when we're talking with patients already. And I suppose the focus on this is about how we communicate with those other the people that support them at home, and particularly from feedback we get from carers about their experience on being on the receiving end of us. Actually, we hold all the knowledge, we hold all the power, and sometimes carers can get a little bit anxious to ask questions or go away from the sort of consultation thinking, I don't really understand what they've said.
And there are lots of situations often where people can't talk for themselves, and those can be some of the more difficult situations to be in communication-wise. You quite often get lots of opinions and agendas that might come to the fore at that point, and it's about learning how to balance those.
So as with everything in medicine, we are bound by law to meet certain requirements to protect our patients, and we're guided by certain ethical principles as well to act in their best interests at all times. So when we're talking with relatives, the two key laws that we come up against are the common law, duty of confidentiality, and the Mental Capacity Act 2005. And there are other relevant laws when we're talking about patient confidentiality and disclosure of confidential information in specific situations, and the GMC have got a lot of guidance on that.
And we've got links to that in the show notes and on the website, and also to the NMC and other society websites as well. Okay, so first, should we talk about the common law duty of confidentiality?
This refers to basically before you disclose any information to a patient's relatives, obviously you need the patient's consent because we have a duty of confidentiality to every patient. And so best practice is always to ask your patient for their consent explicitly before each disclosure. And if there are things that they don't want to be disclosed to relatives, then we have to respect that. But often in clinical practice, we see healthcare professionals assuming that patients consent for relatives to be included in discussion. Example of this would be, I guess, if you're seeing somebody in A&E and the relative is present throughout, you know, the history and examination without the patient's objections, then that's okay. That's implied consent from the patient, and that's common law covers that. In contrast to that, if there's any doubt at all that the patient is giving their consent, or if sensitive information in particular is being discussed, it's really important to have their explicit consent before disclosing any information to relatives. And the main reason that's so important is that if you don't gain consent, that explicit consent for something sensitive, you're potentially compromising the patient's trust in you as a healthcare professional, potentially in all healthcare professionals if they feel like they can't trust you with confidential information. And that's going to affect their subsequent interaction with the health professionals. Mm.
So how do you guys go about that? Let's say you had someone that you were seeing and their family member was present. It's maybe the first time you've met them in A&E, or first or second time. How do you go about that?
I often get the patient to introduce them. So I'll introduce myself specifically to the patient, almost to the point of ignoring the relative, actually. And then I would say to the patient, oh, and who's this that you've got with you? And they'll say, oh, it's my daughter or something. And I say, OK, well, are you happy if they stay? Or are you happy if I have a chat to them afterwards or something? I don't go into it, I have to say, in too much detail, by and large, if it's the first time that I've met someone.
Yeah.
Because often it's, you know, you're taking a history and sort of gaining that rapport, aren't you?
Yeah.
I think if it's something a bit more sensitive, then I often will have the conversation with the patient first and then say, are you happy if I have the similar conversation with your
family? I sometimes use the opportunity for examination to say, I'm going to examine now, do you want to stay? Or, you know, do you want your relative to stay or go? And then you can have a conversation with them while they're there as well. So you're still including the carer or relative or whoever's come with that person, but you're also giving them an opportunity that is not asking them to ask them to leave. That I'm saying, usually I would do this without anybody else here. Is that okay? And then see how they respond to that and kind
Chris,
of take it from there.
You're an Admiral nurse, so a big part of your job is liaising with relatives and people caring and supporting patients. Do you ever find any conflicts there where you find the patient doesn't want you to talk to people?
Well, the tricky is, or the thing I come across often is, particularly in hospital, in acute hospital, people are quite often aren't aware of their diagnosis, or it's quite new still, and they haven't really come to terms, the patient hasn't come to terms with themselves or remember that they've had the diagnosis. So sometimes having a conversation about the dementia is not always easy in front of the front of the patient. So sometimes there's a conversation with the patient about how they're getting on, and then speaking to the relative or the carer away from the patient, so they can have a frank, open conversation about what it's really like to be living with that person. So they're not, the patient hasn't lived with the embarrassment or the distress of actually how they are. So often we'll take them away. It does vary. So sometimes patients can be quite aware of their diagnosis and happy to talk about it, and happy to talk about it with their relative or carer, and sometimes they're not happy to talk about their diagnosis, although they're aware of it in front of their carer. So it's just kind of judging the situation every time. There's never one size fits all.
Yeah.
No, there's not kind of every situation has to be judged on its own merits. And even the same patient, sometimes they're happy to have a conversation with you and their relative, and other times it's a no go. So it's again being aware and just checking in. I mean, one of the biggest challenges as well sometimes with multiple family members, making sure that it's the right person. So is this the appropriate person to be having this conversation with?
I think it's always really important, particularly when you're going to break bad news, to make sure that somebody else is there to support the patient if they want that. As in, if you're going to somebody to tell them bad news and they're by themselves, ask, is there anyone that you would want to be there with them? Because otherwise, sometimes you get into a difficult situation, or you put the patient in a difficult situation where you've broken bad news to them, and then they feel like they have to tell their relatives that. Or maybe then they feel like they don't want the relatives to know that bad news. Whereas if you just told them all together in one go...
Again, that can be quite challenging, though, because sometimes if you lead with that, they then are like, am I going to get bad news? What's going to happen here? So it's a difficult one, that doing
sure.
that...
But then sometimes that is also a warning shot for them so that it doesn't come at them completely out of the blue. If you've said, I'd like to give you some more information, is there anyone you want to come? Are we waiting for anyone to arrive?
Yeah. So next we're going to talk about the Mental Capacity Act.
So I think when people are unwell in hospital, it's common for them to be unable to give consent, whether or not because they are drowsy or they're unconscious, or if they've been delirious, or they have a long-standing cognitive impairment, or a combination of those, they may lack the capacity to give that consent for those conversations. And this is where the Mental Capacity Act becomes relevant. And we've done an episode on the Mental Capacity Act before, so if you don't know what that means, go back to Series 1 and have a listen to the episode on the Mental Capacity Act and then come back to this point. But I think the key thing is to remember the principles of the Mental Capacity Act, and particularly the bit that capacity is decision-specific. So a patient may well have the capacity to make decisions about certain things, but not others. And one of those things that is a specific thing you should check is whether or not they've got capacity to make decisions about giving consent for you to talk to their relatives. But unless you have a reason to doubt somebody's capacity, then by default, you assume they have capacity. Yeah.
And if a person can't give their consent for a healthcare professional to disclose information to their relatives, then it's our responsibility to decide whether it would be in their best interests at that time. And that's kind of, again, quite decision and situation specific. If a relative has power of attorney for health and welfare, then legally we can disclose information relevant to that person to allow them to make decisions regarding that person's treatment. But just remember that you have to see the document. And you need to check that it's for health and welfare. It needs to be registered as well. So quite often people will get confused between next of kin and power of attorney. And it's just from a legal perspective, you need to know how you're making that decision.
I think also lots of relatives just assume they have the right to the information. And also I've come across relatives who assume they have power of attorney because they are their wife or husband next of kin and don't realise there's actually a process. I think the message is getting out there, but there are still people out there who don't really understand what power of attorney is, And so it's been
or people have sometimes got halfway through the process and not registered it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's something else I see.
And I find quite often you actually have to explain to people what that means if they have power of attorney or if they don't. As in, are they making this decision? Mm-hmm. Is this sort of on their shoulders? Or is this a decision I'm making and they're helping me to make it because they know the person best? And sometimes it's good to say that
explaining
to them,
that this is as if you were that person, but it's still a shared decision-making process.
I think sometimes we just assume they're because they have power of attorney, they're experts in what that means. But actually, we have to remember that we're the ones who have that knowledge, and they might not necessarily remember what that means.
Absolutely. I've certainly come across families who felt under pressure to make a decision about a treatment, and actually, they haven't got the understanding of what the treatment is. Mm. So I think again, as professionals, we need to be mindful of that. We're not putting undue pressure onto those families, so having to come up with a decision. So just something to be mindful. Being mindful of the impact that has.
And ethical dilemmas are not uncommon when deciding when to disclose information to relatives. So, for example, if someone has previously expressed that they don't want for their relative to be informed of some of the clinical details of their case and then they lose capacity and we want to involve relatives in overall decision making, then that can be quite difficult. And often there isn't a clear answer there that's you know, right or wrong. But what's really important, as per the Mental Capacity Act, is that we act in the patient's best interests and that we use the least restrictive option. So that might mean, for example, disclosing the minimum amount of information possible to allow relatives to be involved in the decision-making process whilst respecting the patient's previously expressed wishes to withhold certain information from them. And it might mean asking for advocates to be involved or for second opinions from colleagues or ethics committees. A lot of trusts will have clinical ethics committees to help support decision-making in this kind of situation. And so it's worth looking to see whether you do have one, that if you get into quite a tricky situation, that you can look for support from them. And actually, that's one of their main purposes, is to support clinician decision-making in ethically difficult situations.
We've certainly used IMCA's, the Independent Mental Capacity Act, advocates when there's been either no family member or there's a conflict of interest between different family members and we're not quite sure, you know, which one to turn to. Yeah. So it's actually, it helps kind of work our way through the mire.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about some common clinical situations when communications with the relatives might be difficult.
So I guess one of the first things that comes to my mind is when, as a clinician, you're not sure what's going on. Because I think that's always inherently it feels uncomfortable for us because we kind of assume that everyone thinks we should know what's going on. So when you don't know what the diagnosis is, or you don't know what the plan is, or you don't know quite where you're up to with the discharge planning process, I think that's always a tricky conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you just have to sort of put your hands up and go, actually, I don't know what the diagnosis is at the moment. Mm-hmm. This is where we're up to, and this is our thought process that we're kind of navigating through, and this is what we're going to do next and why we're going to do it next, but we don't actually know at the moment. But it's a tricky conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the most difficult sort of communication issues that I come across day to day, is where I just don't know. And I think it's because we talked about how, as clinicians, we've got that power that's sort of inherent in our roles, and when you take that away from us, we actually feel really uncomfortable, and we're just out of our comfort zones.
And it's kind of being aware of that when you're going into these situations, that might be what's unsettling. It might be unsettling for you, and you might misinterpret the situation as well, and that's what's putting an extra strain.
I guess there is always the difference between, why are things difficult? Is it difficult for us, or are the conversations difficult for the relatives? You know, and I think that's one of the ones that sits with, it's difficult for us. It may not be difficult for them.
Yeah. But then I also think that because they do have that trust in us, if we are coming across saying, we don't know what's happening here, which happens commonly, then actually it leaves them feeling quite scared and frightened, unless we can reassure them that there is a plan, even though we don't have the answers yet. So I think it can be difficult both sides, actually.
I know certainly from my experience, relatives will pick up on that anxiety, and they'll often talk to me about having been spoken to with somebody who's been very anxious about what they're about to break to them, and they can come away feeling they actually haven't heard what's been said, and they're quite anxious about how that person came across. And I often see it sometimes with DNR sort of discussions. It's unfortunately usually the most junior member of staff that's being asked to do it, and they're not equipped to kind of deal with the emotion that comes with that.
So there are lots of other situations where you might see that as well. So other upsetting or potentially upsetting topics. So you say things like breaking bad news, deteriorating patients, when a patient's care might be transitioning from what we'd call active to palliative, although, you know, that is still active, but still, you know what I mean when I say that. things about discussions around escalation and resuscitation, especially when the relative's opinions might differ from that of the responsible clinician.
I think that's a particularly tricky one, particularly actually if you are not the responsible clinician. And I think that is a situation when you should escalate things up fairly swiftly to someone that is in a more senior position, be it within your sort of the medical side or as a therapist or as a nurse, whichever. I think if you've got, often you have the situation, don't you, where the decision has been made or suggested and as the consultant, you might say to the CMT or the relatives are coming later, could you catch
from
up with them
and have a chat about this?
Or if you're a therapist, you may be delivering the therapy plan that the more senior therapist has put in place. But actually, if there's a tension there, then, it's a tricky thing for you to try and navigate because you're kind of sandwiched in the middle in a way.
Yeah, I think the key thing there is to kind of recognise when you're hitting a point where you might not be able to get past it and to think about whether that's the right time to stop and ask someone else to come and help, because quite often if you push too hard in that situation and you get it wrong, it may prevent further conversations from happening. So it's a difficult balance, isn't it, from getting the experience with that and not going so far that actually you can't come back from it and the relationship is damaged.
I remember an excellent clinician once telling me that all of these conversations with relatives are like dancing with someone. And when you do dance, if you do a partner dance, you make a move and that you have to wait for the other person to follow your move. And if they don't follow your move, it's pointless you carrying on with that move. They're just going to fall over or your arm's going to hit them in the face. So you have to do something different. And he said it's like that. It's like you're dancing a tango or something and you make a move. And if they follow it, then you can carry on with that move. If you start to make the move and they don't follow it, then you need to try something else and try a different move. So if you're raising the conversation and actually it's
That's just a really nice brick wall.
And they're not ready for that conversation, then you need to step back a little bit and just try a different way around or try a couple of ways and then go, okay, fair enough, we're going to call it a halt now and we'll have that conversation again later on or another time.
I think that's where clinical experience comes in with having these conversations as well. That's why so often we see senior clinicians have these conversations and they seem to go really smoothly. It's because they know more moves than we do. Mm-hmm. And when you're a junior doctor or a junior any sort of healthcare professional, you're still learning the moves and learning from what you've seen other people do that works well. And some things work well with one relative and maybe don't work well in a different situation. Mm-hmm. The more moves you have in your weaponry, the better
you can
and the smoother you're going to be at having those conversations.
There's
one of the bits I'm interested in is the educational thresholds that we go through. And as you come across something that you find difficult or troublesome, one of the first natural human responses to trying to learn that is to mimic and copy. And you will find yourself suddenly saying these words, you're like, oh, where did they come from? And then you'll remember, Dr. such and such, or I saw the sister such and such use these words, and you kind of steal them and you adapt them and you tweak them. But mimicking somebody else is a good way of starting to build up your arsenal of these
and
tools,
work out
if you
what
like.
Works for you. Yeah.
And it's something about actually also challenging yourself as well and actually not carrying away from those difficult conversations, because I think again you'll never learn those skills if you never actually face it.
So next we're going to talk about a few models or frameworks that you might want to use to structure communication. So Sage and Time model is something that's quite commonly talked about. There's quite a few Sage and Time kind of courses around. Our local ones run out of the hospice. I don't know where yours is one from as well.
So Sage and Time is an acronym. And we all like an acronym.
These.
So I think we'll go through the acronym and then we'll talk about what each step means. Yeah. So Sage is setting, ask, gather and empathy. And time is like spelt like the herb. So it's talk, help, you, me, and end. So should we go through how would a conversation run by Sage and Time go?
So first of all, you're looking at what's the right setting, which is the first S. So if you notice that there's a concern, think about what the setting should be. Do you need to be somewhere quite private? In some situations, it might be better to be in an open situation. Is it next to the person that you're talking about with the relative? Is it somewhere else?
So the situation, the setting, do we need to have this conversation now? Mm-hmm. And if we're going to do it now, where is the best place?
That's definitely an important one to think about first, because I'm glad it comes at the start of Sage and Time, because occasionally I've started to have conversations, difficult conversations at the bedside, and then after a couple of minutes realise, or the relatives say, actually, we're not comfortable having this here beside this unconscious person who we're assuming can hear us. Can we please move somewhere else? And you feel bad as a clinician for not having thought of that in advance. And then the other thing I would just add to setting that I find I guess it kind of maybe all comes in the same thing as your body language, as in, are you all standing up? Are you all sitting down? Are you crouching by the bed? You know, can you make eye contact with that person? I don't know if that all comes into setting, but I think that's all really important stuff to think about right at the very start before you start having the conversation.
Yep. And making sure that if you can be bleep free or contact free and that kind of thing that you are, or if you know that you're not going to be able to spend 45 minutes with someone, setting that at the beginning and kind of, yeah, laying that ground.
I think also in there is, does it just need to be you on your own or do you need someone else?
Yeah.
You know, we often work in teams and I think it's useful to have these conversations in teams, actually.
I think so too, yeah.
So then we go on to A for ask.
Asking what their relatives are concerned about. So trying to establish, I guess, what their agenda is, what conversation do they want to have.
And then it's G for gather.
So it's about, again, it's that sort of going beyond the sort of scratching the surface and actually asking slightly more probing questions. Is there anything else you're concerned about? Because often there is, and they haven't maybe not understood what's happening fully and are frightened to ask. So actually giving them the opportunity to say, is there anything else? Is that clear? You know, just gathering a bit more.
And in Stage and Time, they actually say, they tweak the phrasing of that, don't they? So they don't say, is there anything else? They make the assumption there is. So they say, is there something else? Mm-hmm. Which I think is quite nice as a, you know, there is something, tell me about it, you know.
And sometimes I say, this is what I wanted to talk to you about today. What do you want to talk about at the beginning so that you know where it's going to go?
Then we go on to E for empathy.
Responding with empathy and being sensitive, you know, appreciating that they've got a lot on their mind, trying to get an idea of how much they want to talk about at that time and that kind of thing.
So, and then we're going to move on to the time. So it's T for talk.
So who do you have to help?
So that's, again, thinking about who else can they talk to? Who else can you get in to help with this conversation? Mm-hmm. If it's going to be a conversation in two parts, who's going to follow up from you? Okay. Then there's H for help.
So it's again, it's how do they help? So it's sort of being clear how the person that is going to help them is going to do that. So being absolutely clear on what support's out there for the person. Because again, you don't want somebody going away thinking, I've been given this information, I don't really understand it, where do I go with it?
Then there's you, why for you.
So asking them, what do you think would help?
And then there's M for me.
Is there something you would like me to do?
And then the final bit is E for end.
So, and again, like I've said before, about just really summarising and being clear on what it is you've talked about and that you've gone away from the conversation, hopefully confident they've understood as well. So, yeah.
And Sage and Time's nice because it kind of splits it into the two bits. So the Sage bit is about information gathering and getting people's concerns out, and the Time is about making a clear plan and getting all the help that people might need.
And the other structured communication that is worth thinking about is SBAR as well, which is... So you've done some work with.
Yeah, so there's some podcasts on the same website as this. Yeah, there's six, 7 minute long podcasts about SBAR from a teaching programme that I run in care homes. And there's an online learning tool on the eLearning for Health website that's freely accessible as well.
It's something we use in hospital all the time, but not so much in the community, which is why you're doing that project. So do you want to tell us what it stands for?
So SBAR stands for S is situation, B is background, A is assessment, and R is recommendation. So I think in terms of talking to relatives, it would be something like this. So the situation, so the patient, your mother, your father, your daughter, is unwell, and I wanted to talk to you today about that. Then you'd move on and you talk about the background. Well, you know, they were admitted to hospital a few days ago. They've been having some treatment for a pneumonia, and we've been giving them antibiotics and some oxygen and some fluids. Then you move on to assessment, but unfortunately they're not getting better with this treatment, and you know, you talk about that in a bit more detail, and then the recommendation might be, you know, we think now's the time to transition from more active treatment. Maybe we should stop the antibiotics and sort of ensure that they're comfortable for the time that's left in their life, or whatever the conversation is. But I think it does fit in that process. And I think what's helpful about both of those acronyms is it just gives you something to sort of hang the information around. And when things are difficult and it's tricky, it's nice to have some kind of structure to fall back on rather than sort of freewheeling it.
A bit like maybe having your basic dance moves.
Yes.
To fall back on. You say, yes. Okay, well, I know this always works, or I know that this is a good place to start, is going back to those, I guess, using them as a bit of a crutch. So next we're going to just run through some practical tips for communicating with relatives. So first off, establish who you're speaking to and don't make assumptions. I've really painful experience of an F2 when I was an F1 doing this, and just calling the mum the daughter and the daughter the mum. I just repeatedly, it was awful. But find out what the patient support network looks like. Are there other people who should be present for important discussions before you get too far into something with one person who may not be the right person?
I think it's a bit about recognising and acknowledging the emotions that may be in the room, both yours and also the relatives. And fear can sometimes look a bit like anger. And they may feel like they're not being involved in what's happening to their relatives, and that can feel really quite frightening for people. And especially if people feel, and relatives often do feel, actually, like they're being kept in the dark, because we will have conversations with the patients on our ward rounds and during your therapy sessions, and we sort of rely on the patients to feed that back information back to the relatives. But and that's, I think, technically the correct way to do it, but also the relatives will then often come into hospital and say, well, nobody has spoken to us. And you can entirely understand that position, and that automatically puts you in a bit of a tension. And if you can get that ironed out at the start, often everything is much better for the entire rest of the admission.
Following on from that, miscommunications and mixed messages from different team members can be quite frustrating, and it can be quite frightening if you don't feel like one person is really in charge, or you've not had consistency with anybody, or, you know, maybe the plan has changed during the admission, and that can feel like mixed messages. I think try not to get too defensive about that. Apologise, kind of take a couple of steps back, make sure everyone's on the same page before you start moving on again.
Stroke units do this very well, don't they? Where patients are often in for a period of time, they often have a key worker who takes on the main communication with the relatives, and that often works really well.
Yeah. And actually, on the flip side of that as well, and coming from a large family myself and being on the receiving end of this, when there's lots of, sort of multiple family members and they're all wanting the same information, actually establishing who is the contact person. Yeah. And otherwise, because the staff are going to be constantly kind of repeating this. And that's when you said to my brother this. And so it's really important to have that consistent approach. And then you're also, it goes back to your first point, establishing who the person you're talking to is. But especially where there's a large family, and just being aware of the, kind of some of the dynamics that have gone there as well. Yeah. People often come out of the woodwork when people are in hospital, which for all sorts of reasons. Yeah.
I think the other relevant thing there is, if you've had an important conversation with relatives, then to feed that back to your MDT so that everybody is on the same page. Mm-hmm.
And to document it so that everyone, you know, and in clear detail so that everyone can read it and go, ah, that's exactly what we've said. That's what they've been told.
Neat handwriting. Yes. Underline important parts.
Yes.
And the next one we kind of said already as well, that you assume the unconscious patient can hear you, mm-hmm. because the relatives will almost always assume that the unconscious patient is listening. Mm-hmm. And they find it really upsetting to have difficult conversations in front of them.
It's the same patients with dementia as well. I think being mindful that they will have some understanding, and not to assume just because they have a diagnosis. Yeah. We see it often in Lensbury's and dementia that people make the assumption that they don't understand, but actually we have to be mindful that they do.
When you're talking to someone, as we said earlier, establish your agenda, establish their agenda right at the start of the conversation. And if there's quite a lot to discuss or time is short, then it can help to set out clearly, like stating the learning objectives if you were doing a teaching session or something like that, or like a GP might do when they're quite time limited, say, well, this is what we've got time to talk about today, and if we need to talk about something else, then we can set a time to do that again.
And I think that the key thing is about being flexible. Sometimes you will go into a conversation with your agenda, and actually it becomes very clear that the relatives are on a completely different page, and actually your agenda is no longer relevant. You need to very rapidly work out that it's not relevant and adjust your expectations of what you're going to achieve in this conversation, and vice versa. You know, I've had conversations where I've gone in intending on just having the first little bit of a conversation, and actually, you know, a minute in, it's very apparent that the relatives are a few pages ahead of me, and actually I need to very quickly, you know, whiz forward a little bit.
It's surprising how often that happens actually in clinical practice, and that the family are actually way ahead of you or where you thought that they were going to be.
Yeah.
And I always try and take advantage of that, as in, if I've got the relevant people there at that time and we need to be making plans for the future, then take the opportunity to do it, because you don't actually know if you're going to have that time to sit down with them again and have a proper discussion.
The other side of that as well is thinking, if someone's going to be in for some time, that you can pace yourself, you can build a relationship with those people, and you don't have to do it all in that one sitting.
And I think being aware that some people are big picture viewers and other people are sort of little picture micro management viewers, and you know, conversation will be different for different people.
Yeah, and that can even vary within the same conversation if you're talking to multiple people, which is difficult to manage.
But I quite often say, are you a big picture headlines kind of person, or are you want all the detail kind of person? That's kind of helpful to distinguish.
I always find it really really important during conversations where we're making important decisions about escalation or resuscitation to emphasise to the relative that unless they have power of attorney and it's really them making the decision legally, that the decisions are my decisions and they're helping me to make them. Mm-hmm. And to make it clear to them that it's not on their shoulders, because people feel a huge amount of pressure for making decisions about DNAR if they think it's all on them.
I think it's worth it. Explicitly saying it exactly like you just did, actually. I tend to say that, and it's my decision. I'm taking everything that goes with that, you know.
Be mindful of cultural differences that might be present in conversations, and we're going to do an episode on that later in this series. Support networks can be hugely diverse, and it's really important to approach every patient with an open mind and not to make assumptions before you've gathered all the right information about what they might or might not want or what support may or may not be available.
It's also a good point, you know, especially again if you've got advance directives, have you seen a copy of that or advance plans, or if they've got a reach out to me or a butterfly, this is me, you know, what's on there? Is there any information in there that can be useful in these sort of discussions or decisions as well?
And the really important thing is, just because you're comfortable talking about difficult topics doesn't mean that relatives or carers are. And relatives can get really anxious that patients will find some conversations quite distressing. And sometimes that's absolutely correct. And sometimes it's not. So it can be quite helpful to test the waters sometimes ahead of any conversations with the family, with the person directly, to kind of establish, A, how much they themselves want to talk about, and secondly, how much they want their family to know or be involved with at the outset can be really helpful.
Yeah, so sometimes if I'm seeing a patient in the morning on my ward round and they're deteriorating and we need to have a conversation about that, I sometimes find it helpful to give a sort of a warning shot, saying to the patient, I'm worried about you today. Mm-hmm. And just see how they respond to that. And if they go, oh, goodness, that's terrible, I hope not, like, I thought you were going to make me better, then maybe that's the time to leave that conversation there. But sometimes they'll be completely on the same page as you and they'll want to talk about it. So I find something really sort of benign like that, I'm worried about you, a good way to open
it. It's a good
that.
Opener, isn't it? Definitely.
I think sometimes when you're talking to relatives about something that's difficult, just being human, acknowledging that it's difficult and saying, you know, this is a difficult thing for us all to talk about. And I think, you know, just acknowledging that and acknowledging that their concerns and their worries, I think is a key thing. But equally, just because it's an upsetting topic doesn't mean it's a topic we should shy away from and not talk about, you know. Mm. And again, I think that's useful just to vocalise sometimes to people, you know.
And sometimes when you're in that situation, remembering that you're advocating for your patient. And sometimes it can be useful to point out how it would feel to be kept in the dark. So to not know that something is wrong, that if you're dying but nobody's talking to you about it, is really important.
Yeah, I think that's kind of comes in where the patient maybe lacks capacity to be making decisions about their care, but that's not a reason to keep them completely in the dark. Yeah. And the family are really worried that if you tell them they're dying, that they'll give up or that they'll be traumatized by it. And sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. So
just finally, we're just going to talk about some particularly challenging scenarios. So for example, DNA CPR conversations and decisions about treatment escalation. And these can be challenging because of uneasiness of the situation on both sides. And so we talked earlier about situations in which patients and relatives can feel uncertain or at sea, and this can impact the types of conversations that you'll have with them, including how emotional they become at the time. But the same will happen to you, and that's why, as we said, senior colleagues can sometimes seem to have what seems like exactly the same conversation, but it goes better. So it can help to feel as prepared as you can on your side for these conversations. Also to take a moment to reflect before you start a conversation. You know, if it's the middle of an on-call, you know, are you tired? Are you stressed? Are you hungry? And you might not be able to do anything about those things at that particular time, but even just having an awareness of where you are and what you might bring to that interaction. As you were saying earlier, Chris, you know, picking up if someone looks busy, stressed and doesn't want to be here, even though you might want to be there, that's really important to think about what you're bringing to that conversation, because it will help how it goes.
We touched on some of those things in the psychodynamic episodes that we did, which was 5.1, I think.
Yeah.
Talking about the psychodynamics of these conversations.
Yeah, what you're bringing and what other people.
It's important to remember decisions of this sort, DNAR decisions, are legally medical decisions. A person can't insist on having a futile treatment. An equivalent for therapists would be that a relative can't insist on bed-based rehab if they wouldn't benefit from it. Power of attorney means speaking with that person, the relative, as though they are the person they are advocating for. So although they are speaking on behalf of that person, it still doesn't give them the right to insist on treatments that would be futile, as the person wouldn't have that right either.
And that's the same for an IMCA as well.
And then next of kin, in the absence of a power of attorney, technically has no legal standing. So I think we would all agree that active involvement in decision making should be undertaken, so we should involve the next of kin in decision making, but no one, including the person themselves nor the power of attorney, can insist on a futile treatment.
And I think a big bit here is about actually joint and shared decision making and working out the common ground between you and the patient and the relatives early on is going to help with this. So I think just sort of working out what they know and what they see as the next step in the treatment, or the next thing that you want to, you know, the thing that you want to talk about, sort of gaining their opinion about that first.
And ways that I try to do that are things like, or trying to bring us onto the same page by actually having a conversation about it. So I might say things like, so your mother's been quite unwell for a few months now, tell me about what's been happening. And that often gives that person an opportunity to acknowledge any deterioration leading up until that point. And they're telling you, not you telling them, you know, your mum's been getting worse. Things like, you mentioned that your mum can't walk very far. That might lead to a discussion about physiological reserve in the face of an illness. Saying, your mum is very unwell right now. Have the two of you ever had conversations like this before about what she would or wouldn't want in situations like this? So again, they're quite open, they're soft. They're not asking for firm decisions, framing it more as a conversation, a natural thing that you might gather their opinion for. Another really useful phrase I've started using recently is, if your mum could hear us talking now, what do you think she would say about this? And that often alleviates the pressure that relative might feel about having that responsibility, because they're kind of voicing what they think their mum would say. I think that can be quite helpful.
It's also quite useful sometimes to engage to gauge how aware the care is. I've certainly come across families who, because you're in hospital, you're going to get better, but actually you've seen the deterioration and they're not facing that, and they're saying, we'll just get some fluids into it and she'll be fine, but actually you know that actually everything is kind of moved away from just fluids and getting somebody better. And so having quite a frank and honest conversation and presenting a bit of reality as well sometimes can be quite useful. It's difficult, but I think, and again, that's that conversation about what you think, where the journey is, actually highlighting that can be very useful.
So I think that summarises everything really we wanted to say. Let us know your thoughts. You can contact us on Twitter at @MDT_podcast or on Facebook.
.com/MDT podcast.
Or via the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk.
What we're really interested in is, we're thinking about next series, or maybe the series after, doing a further episode on this, but actually working through some difficult scenarios. So if you would like us to do that, then please use the website, email us, tweet us, or send us a message on Facebook about the kind of scenarios you might want us to do. And if we get enough interest that's something you'd like, then we might look at playing some of those out, so less theory like this and actually trying some different ways of talking to people, maybe with actors, to kind of see how that feels and to try some things out. So let us know if that's something you'd like.
And Dan Thomas runs an MDT journal club for us, and that's using the hashtag MDT club. And also, while we're talking about the website, is a new CPD feedback form. So if you type in your feedback and you get a copy, we get a copy, and we use that to tailor our episodes. There's the show notes, there's also the free infographic and the curriculum mapping, that's all on the website. So head down to that, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk.
The MDT Podcast.
But now it is time for the MD teaser. This is our catchily titled MDT item guessing game. So, Keris and Chris, please feel free to jump in. Jo has what she has described as the best one yet.
So I really think it is.
We'll see how this goes.
Ian was also like, no, mine is amazing. I really think so. I'm going to go first. Okay. Yeah. So, picture the scene. There's a rocket. It's shooting towards the stars, there's darkness in the background. Inside the rocket is a person who is sat down, but they aren't quite
Elton
sat.
John, Rocket Man.
How is that an MDT
item? It's the wrong game, sorry. Okay.
Inside the rocket is a person sat down, but they're not quite sat upright, they're at a slight angle. I can give you another clue if you need.
That's it?
That's it. Would you like me to repeat it, or do you want the further?
Someone in a rocket at a slight angle.
Mm-hmm.
So rocket.
They're
rocket
sitting at a slight angle.
Is there any sort of chair that reclines that's named after a rocket? I wouldn't know.
Or a space. Are you sure it's not Elton John Rocket Man?
Would you like the further clue?
Yes.
The further clue is abstract, I'll tell you now. This person is sat drinking a drink, but they're not quite sure what it is because they couldn't quite hear the name right, but it's got a totally tropical taste.
It's a tilt table.
Yay!
Come on, that was awesome. It's a man.
That was good.
Sat at a tilt in space.
Okay, so my one is there is a person lying in a bed who's clearly a patient, and they're in a room on their own, and into the room comes a dog, and the dog comes in and he walks around the bed, jumps on the bed, sits on the bed, the man has a stroke, and then the dog leaves, and then a few moments later a cat comes in and walks around the bed and sits
like
on
Pat,
the bed.
Patience's treatment.
Yeah, it's pet therapy.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Easy.
Cool.
And then we have the next little feature at the end is the gallery.
So my gallery item for this episode is from a book called A Trib and Other Stories by Eli Williams. And it's a book of short stories. I'm going to read you one called, the beginning of one called The Alphabet, which is about a lady who talks about her relationship as she gets diagnosed with aphasia and dementia. But it's really, really lovely and the language is really gorgeous. So, the plot of this is not and will not be obvious. I'm pretending that this is not important. It is quite likely that I have lost it anyway. The plot. Related, where are my glasses? For some reason, I find that if I say glasses, glasses, in an authoritative way whilst I'm searching for them, it seems more likely that I shall find them, or that somehow, that I will somehow invoke them into being. This is a strategy that does not work for finding one's dignity, nor for finding you, but glasses, possibly. Announcing my intention to find them, at least, conveys a sense of control as I dither around picking up ornaments and looking under curtains. There is a paper published online that sets this out in a thesis. I shall quote it aloud to make it real. Speech can alter ongoing cognitive and even perceptual processing in non-trivial ways, effectively allowing one to concentrate better. Say it ain't so. Announce with an ounce of courage and conviction that the world's yours for the mistaking. For what it's worth, concentrating, I can say that you altered me in non-trivial ways. The pursuit was anything but trivial, at least, I remember that. Glasses? I completely lost it, the plot, not the glasses, they're only mislaid, about 2 weeks ago, around the same time that I mislaid you. If you were here, you would make a filthy joke about my use of that word, about you being mislaid. Scratch that then, screw it, or unscrew that word out of place. 2 weeks ago is when I lost it, the plot. Around about the same time that you were not mislaid by me, but were misplaced. When you misplaced me. 2 weeks ago is when we ceased to converge by the bedside table, beneath the sofa, by the fridge. I have realised with some embarrassment that the reason I cannot find them, of course, is that I'm wearing my glasses. This is like that time that someone, I'm being coy, I mean you, complimented my eyes, and suddenly I wish that I can pop them out into your palm and say, hey, damn right, they're the best thing about me. Not, you know, functionally, of course, hence the glasses, but in terms of form. Do you want to swap? I want to see you in them. Which, of course, would be impossible for 3 reasons and horrible for about 12, but what was it that I was saying? Even though I now know the whereabouts of my glasses, the feeling of lack remains. I have lost something else, so here I must remain, poised to retrieve. If I say something else, in an authoritative way, perhaps it is more likely that I will find whatever it might be. It's really gorgeous.
Yeah. So,
I could read it all, but I won't. so yes, that's but Eli Williams, A Trib and Other Stories. I would highly recommend it. The book is not all about dementia. It's just a series of short stories, and that one happens to be. So it's a nice book. The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a Hearing Aid Podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.